Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Another dark milestone. The U.S. death toll jumps past 4,500 as top officials warn the best case scenario will mean hundreds of thousands die. Then the question of masks. As medical experts send mixed signals on whether wearing a mask is needed, what we need to know so far about facial protection and the pandemic. Plus, the pandemic abroad, how Taiwan got it right, preparing early and urgently to meet the threat of COVID-19.
When I first arrived home, there were like three or four text messages. Welcome back to Taiwan. This is the CDC. We're just checking to see if you're okay.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The United States has more than 200,000 coronavirus infections as of tonight, with some 4,600 deaths. That is a 50% increase over the past 2 days. And the World Health Organization is warning that the global count will shortly top 1 million cases with 50,000 deaths. The pandemic is taking its greatest toll in New York and other hotspots. John Yang begins our coverage.
As the coronavirus death toll in New York City nears 2,000 people, officials warn today that fatalities in the pandemic's epicenter will continue to rise. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said that should be a warning to all of America.
I say to my fellow governors and elected officials all across this country, look at us today, see yourself tomorrow.
In New York Harbor, the U.S. Navy hospital ship the Comfort prepared to care for non-COVID-19 patients in hopes of easing the strain on overwhelmed hospitals. And in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis today issued a stay-at-home order, a step he had resisted for several days, even as cases in his state had risen. Later, Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, another holdout, said he would sign a stay-at-home order tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Navy responded to the request from the commander of the USS Theodore Roosevelt, docked in Guam, to evacuate the aircraft carrier's 5,000-person crew to stem an onboard outbreak.
We cannot and will not remove all the sailors from the ship. And that's not what the commanding officer requested either, nor the medical team. Our plan has always been to remove as much of the crew as we can while maintaining for the ship's safety.
In Detroit, people lined up for a drive-through testing site. The city is facing an uptick in cases, and officials say it's shaping up to be the country's next hotspot. Mayor Mike Duggan.
Somebody brought the virus into this community early on. It spread in this community before we knew what was happening. And the places in this country that are getting hit are the places that were infected first.
As that grim reality settles in, President Trump has begun preparing Americans for the worst. At the White House yesterday, he said he's been on top of the issue from the start.
I knew everything. I knew it could be horrible, and I knew it could be maybe good. Don't forget, at that time, people didn't know that much about it. Even the experts, we were talking about it. We didn't know where it was going.
But in late January,
we have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
The White House late yesterday published projections that suggest the virus will take the lives of at least 100,000 Americans in the coming months. Already in Europe, there have been more than 30,000 deaths. In hard-hit Spain, empty streets in Madrid, save for a few pigeons. A stoplight turns green, but no cars on the road. The country's recorded more than 100,000 cases, including Fernando Simon, who's leading the country's response. Today, he spoke from his home.
Right now, we are not in the battle to see if we are or are not in the maximum infection point, because it appears that we are there and we are descending. So now the battle is to make sure that our health system is able to guarantee the adequate cover for all of our patients in treatment.
Elsewhere in Europe, police tape surrounded an empty Moscow playground. Prague's riverbanks disinfected. London music arenas turned into testing centers. Also in London, this time-lapse video of a 4,000-bed hospital being built in just 2 weeks. The Nightingale Hospital opened today to help care for an influx of coronavirus patients. Meanwhile, the Wimbledon tennis tournament, still 4 months away, joined the growing ranks of events called off due to the pandemic. The first time Wimbledon's been canceled since World War II. But in Italy, a glimmer of hope.
We must not confuse the first positive signals that we are seeing in these hours with an all-clear signal. Data and the statistical projections made by experts show that we are on the right path and that the drastic decisions we have adopted so far are starting to bear fruit.
Officials there say they will stay under a national lockdown until at least April 13th. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
The rising tide of infections drove financial markets sharply lower today. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 973 points to close at 20,943. The Nasdaq fell 339 points, and the S&P 500 dropped nearly 115. And now to a public official who has personally battled the disease and is now trying to lead his city during this crisis. I'm joined by Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, recently out of a 19-day quarantine. Mayor Suarez, thank you very much for joining us. We're very glad to see you've recovered and come through this. But I want to start by asking you about Governor DeSantis' decision or announcement today that he is finally joining, 30 other governors around the country in ordering a statewide stay-at-home in Florida. Was this the right time, or did he wait too long?
Well, it definitely was time. We had ordered a stay-at-home order in the city of Miami days ago, if not weeks ago. And we were the first city in Dade County to order a stay-at-home, the first city to order a curfew. And so it was important and imperative that the governor do likewise. I think when it's all said and done, we're going to look back and we're going to ask ourselves, did we do everything that we could do to prevent this virus from spreading in our communities? And I think that has to be our guidepost right now. The other concern I have is our airport, which brings in 20 million people and where 50 million people come through our city.
Did you urge the governor during this time, since your city issued stay at home from today? Have you been urging the governor to do this?
I've been in constant communication with the governor, and I let him know when we issued our stay at home order that we would welcome a statewide stay at home order as well. And I think at the time, you know, there were 20 counties that did not have any cases and five counties that have five cases or less. But I think the issue is that we, again, have to do everything that we can do, which is why we're the first city to cancel large events, to issue a stay-at-home order, to issue a curfew, because we have to do everything that we can to prevent the spread of this virus, and including myself, who was the second person in Dade County that tested positive.
For sure. Well, tell us about the situation in Miami City. What is it looking like there with regard to the number of cases and how people are, how people's are being handled, their medical situation?
We are sort of the epicenter of Florida. We have the most cases in the entire state. We are ramping up our ability to test. We just opened a testing site yesterday. We're testing several hundred people a day, which means most likely that our cases are going to continue to go up, and we don't believe that we are anywhere near the apex. I find it hard to believe that I was only the second person positive in the entire county. So there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people that are going undiagnosed or that we don't know are positive. And so we need to get control of exactly how many people are positive. We have to do contact tracing to make sure that we can do, like we said, everything that we can to flatten this curve.
Do you have the people, the personnel, the supplies, the equipment that you need to deal with what's going on in your city?
We were very fortunate. Our fire chief identified this threat very early on during the time that it was in Wuhan. Right around the time of the Super Bowl, we hosted the Super Bowl this year in early February, and he started purchasing personal protective equipment back then, spent millions of dollars, even without even getting authorization. And so we are well-stocked. I've been in constant communication with the hospital system, our public hospital system, which is the fourth largest in the country. I've been told, or I'm being told so far, has sufficient beds. But as we've seen with Italy, as we've seen with Spain, as we've seen with New York, this this run on hospital services can happen very, very quickly. And so we are trying to add capacity to our hospital system by having, as you were showing in some of the opening clips, by having portable beds available offsite in some of our parks.
And at this point, tell us what effect it's having on the broader community. Clearly, people staying at home, people in every occupation, job you can imagine, there's no income. How are you dealing with that?
That's an enormous concern, especially since it's April 1st. It's the beginning of the month. And so I'm of the opinion, I've written the governor, and I will ask the president here on this show, that we need to have mortgage and rent relief immediately. There needs to be a suspension, whether it's 60 days, 90 days of mortgage and rent payments. People need to be able to have enough money to eat. And that's got to be the most important and essential thing that people use their money for. We in the city allocated $2 million, $1 million to feed our elderly, and $1 million to feed those below the poverty level. But, you know, we're going to, if we don't take dramatic steps to make sure that we alleviate some of the more significant financial burdens in people's lives, my fear is it could get apocalyptic.
Apocalyptic, you really mean that?
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand that in a city like Miami, we, after 9 days, you know, without power, when there's a hurricane, it can get pretty apocalyptic. You know, people get very desperate when they don't have some of the basics. And so for me, I think what's imperative is that residents get mortgage and rent relief immediately so that they can use the money that they have in conjunction with, of course, the unemployment benefits that they're going to get from the state and the federal government to pay for the most basic necessities. That is going to be what people are going to be focusing on. I hope that we don't ever get to an apocalyptic like scenario, obviously. And we are doing everything in the city to prevent that from happening. But that's what we have to be prepared for. And we have to prepare ourselves in terms of the economic impact that this is having on people's lives.
Well, Mayor Francis Suarez of Miami City, we certainly wish you the best with all of that. And we're so glad to see you doing better after going through the coronavirus. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
As you've been hearing, this is a tough time for many hospitals in larger cities and in smaller ones. And there are growing concerns for rural areas as well. The next few weeks are expected to be especially difficult as workers are pressed and there is serious concern over a lack of protective equipment. William Brangham has the latest in our series of conversations with healthcare workers and officials on the front lines.
We get two perspectives on this now from two different medical centers around the country. Dr. Philip Kuhl is chief medical officer for Augusta University Health System in Georgia. And Michael Dowling is president and CEO of Northwell Health in New York State. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for being here. I know you're both busy trying to care for all the people coming through your doors, and we appreciate you being here. Michael Dowling, to you first. We have all of us who are not in New York are following what has been going on there, and we see how difficult it seems to be. You run the biggest healthcare system in that state. Could you just give us a sense, how are things there? What are your ICUs like? Are they full now?
Yes, obviously, we're in the epicenter right now in New York, so it is hectic, extremely busy. The numbers are pretty extraordinary. In our health system alone right now, we've got about 2,500 positive patients, COVID-positive patients in our hospitals. That grows every day by about 300. So life changes. I mean, everything about a hospital, everything about the way you worked a month and a half ago is all different. The hospitals are all working together. We're collaborating, but we're managing and trying obviously to stay ahead of it because we're in the midst of a major, major battle here with a very resilient competitor, the virus. But my view is that we will persist here, and at the end of the day, we will make sure that we win in this battle against this virus. And that's the optimism you got to have in a situation like this.
And Dr. Kuhl, I understand being in Georgia, you might be a little bit behind where New York is right now. I understand that you've been doing an enormous amount of testing of patients and of people in the general population. Can you give us a sense of what the value of that testing is, what it allows you to do?
Sure. So we do have the advantage of being later in this wave of patients that we expect from COVID-19. We have a distinct advantage being an academic medical center at Augusta University, where we were able to get ahead of the curve on testing. And we've been testing for quite some time, a very efficient telemedicine screening program, as well as a drive-up testing program that has allowed us to identify those at risk and identify positive cases to help us stay ahead of this. Other areas within Georgia, as you know, even rural areas have been hit hard, particularly Albany, Georgia. Some of those patients are being transferred to us. And then some other rural areas where this appears to be hitting harder, those patients are coming to our facility. But as of right now, we have a team that has helped keep us ahead of this thing.
And I'm curious, Dr. Kuhl, staying with you for a moment, we know that lots of hospitals facing very, very sick patients have had to wrestle with these very wrenching decisions that in an era of limited capacity, limited supply of things like ventilators, that people have to wrestle with, how do we decide who gets a scarce ventilator and who doesn't? How do you think about those things? How do you as a system debate those things?
Sure. So one of the principles of a disaster is triage, and you have to triage and make very difficult decisions about who is the greatest benefit for a ventilator. For example, if you can predict that a very elderly patient is not going to survive, then perhaps if you do have scarce resources, then you need to reallocate that resource. Now, we're not to that point, and we're have the advantage of being able to have those discussions in the setting of the calm before the storm. Others, unfortunately, have been thrown into making those very difficult decisions very early. As it stands now, our medical center, we are counting the surplus of ventilators. We are worried about it, but right now we're in good shape.
Michael Dowling, obviously, is the head of a much bigger system. I'm curious, you have an enormous number of employees who are working with people on the front lines. How is your staff? How are those frontline workers holding up? How are they doing? I understand some of your staff have already themselves become infected.
Yes, we've had quite a number of staff infected, both on the front lines as well as in the management staff. But I have been out on the floors, and I have been out in the ICUs and out meeting with staff. And I can tell you that when you're out there and you watch the dedication and the commitment of these staff, it is pretty extraordinary. A key part of it, of course, is making sure that you have the supplies. And all of the debate and the national media about masks and gowns and gloves and ventilators gets people concerned, not only the providers, but also the public. But when you're able to assure your employees that you have the masks, that you have the PPE protective equipment, that they don't have to worry about that, that one of your major foci is to make sure the staff is safe and secure, that helps enormously.
Indeed. Dr. Kuhl, we have been seeing governors, mayors, public health officials all across the country saying, we need everyone to stay inside. If you're not an essential worker, please stay home. Keep your distance from others. I understand that that has been a particular challenge in some rural areas around you where people simply are not listening to those warnings.
It has. In fact, we were particularly concerned about our churches and houses of worship, and actually actively, our pastoral staff actively reached out to them to encourage them not to hold in-person services. Unfortunately, we do have some churches to the south of us that we either did not reach or they didn't get the message, but they held in-person services despite that. And we're now seeing the impact of that with outbreaks that are tied to those churches.
All right. You both are obviously doing incredibly important work, and we thank you both very much for being here. Dr. Philip Kuhl and Michael Dowling, thank you both very, very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
In the day's other news, there is word from U.S. intelligence that China vastly understated its own death toll in the pandemic. Two senior U.S. officials tell the NewsHour that the true number of dead in Wuhan, where the outbreak began, could exceed 25,000. That is roughly 10 times what Wuhan reported. Beijing claims that about 3,300 people died from across all of China. President Trump said this evening that those numbers seem to be, quote, a little bit on the light side. In Iran, President Hassan Rouhani accused the United States today of missing a historic opportunity to ease tensions during the pandemic. He said Washington could have eased sanctions on Iran, where COVID-19 has infected some 48,000 people and killed 3,000.
This was a good time. This was an opportunity for Americans to apologize for their wrong actions. This was a human issue, and no one would have reproached them for backing off. This was the best historic opportunity for the Americans to come back from the wrong path they have chosen and to tell the Iranian nation just once that we are not against the Iranian people.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo denied on Tuesday that sanctions affect humanitarian aid to Iran, but he did not rule out easing the financial penalties. Back in this country, West Virginia became the latest state to delay its presidential primary because of the coronavirus. The May 12th vote was pushed back to June 9th. Meanwhile, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders urged the state of Wisconsin to postpone its primary, which is set for next Tuesday. A new report finds widespread sexual harassment in the federal government's workforce. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights estimates that nearly one in seven federal employees experienced sexual harassment between 2016 and 2018. The rate of women filing claims shot up over those years, with black women particularly at risk. The Food and Drug Administration today told drug makers to stop selling Zantac and similar heartburn medications. They are all versions of a drug known as ranitidine, and the FDA says they may be tainted with a cancer-causing chemical. Many companies have already removed the products from shelves. And this is officially Census Day. Traditionally, wherever you are living today is listed as your residence in the 2020 census. So far, though, the COVID-19 pandemic has forced the Census Bureau to suspend door-to-door counting. Officials say they still expect to finish by year's end. Still to come on the NewsHour, the shifting messages on masks from top health officials in the U.S. An ugly symptom, racism against Asian Americans in the wake of the pandemic. To Taiwan, where health officials moved quickly and may have prevented disaster. Plus, how Americans are adapting to a new and uncertain way of life.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A majority of the country is now being told to stay at home and to keep their distance from others to try and stop the spread of the coronavirus. Now, some in the public health community are wondering if the general public should also be wearing face masks. William Brangham is back with a report on the growing debate.
Face masks are a critical protective shield for the medical workers who are caring for the sickest COVID-19 patients. This virus enters the body via tiny droplets through the eyes, nose, and mouth, so putting a barrier over the face can help stop infection. In these wards, masks are meant to be worn every moment workers are exposed to the virus. But what about the rest of us outside hospitals?
What about those of us who have to go to work around other people? Should we be wearing masks? What about people who, when they need to leave the house to go to the grocery store or the doctor, should they wear a mask then? And if everyone did, would that change the course of this pandemic? The government's advice about all of this may be changing.
Until just recently, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said only health personnel and people confirmed to be sick with COVID-19 should be wearing masks. And similarly, that's what Dr. Anthony Fauci argued just a few weeks ago on 60 Minutes.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask.
Even earlier this week, the U.S. Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, said masks on the general population not only wouldn't help, but might hurt.
Wearing a mask improperly can actually increase your risk of getting disease. It can also give you a false sense of security.
Dr. Leanna Wen, an emergency physician at George Washington University and Baltimore's former public health director, agrees.
There just isn't evidence that everyone wearing masks will prevent the transmission of coronavirus in our communities. The recommendation is that people who are ill should be wearing masks, and certainly healthcare workers should be wearing masks. But everyday people, the recommendation is not that everyone should be going around wearing masks.
But that recommendation may be changing. The head of the CDC said new evidence indicates that a significant percentage of people without symptoms may be unknowingly spreading the virus. If they wore masks, perhaps even homemade fabric ones, it's believed that transmission could be reduced. Dr. Harlan Krumholtz is a cardiologist and healthcare researcher at Yale University.
There are plenty of people in society who are going to work every day, placing themselves at risk in order to keep society going, in order to deliver packages, to provide groceries, to enable those vital services, policemen and firemen and firewomen and policewomen, all going out and doing their jobs, but placing themselves in positions where they're around others. It's incumbent upon us to protect them. They themselves need to be wearing masks and protective gear, but we also need to be wearing masks to protect them.
N95 masks are considered the best, then surgical masks like these. Right now, there aren't many rigorous studies comparing the effectiveness of surgical masks to handmade cloth ones. But one thing we do know, right now, medical-grade masks are in short supply nationwide. Here's just one example. Jennifer Radovich is a registered nurse at West Virginia University Medicine's Ruby Memorial Hospital, a hospital with a growing number of coronavirus cases. Because her wing has no N95 masks left, Radovich turned to Facebook, appealing for help.
I figured that would be the best way to reach the public and just said, this is what we need. I just kept sending messages out saying, like, please help, we need these. And I have had a great response.
Donated masks from individuals, local construction crews, even auto body shops started coming in.
I gotta say, it just seems a little bit crazy that you as a nurse have to be calling construction crews and auto mechanics trying to get masks to protect you in a hospital.
Right. Amazon has been sold out of them for weeks. I've even seen them on eBay. I've seen a box of 24 as high as $699. With 24 bids on it.
Wow.
So, yeah, this is a real problem.
Dr. Leanna Wen argues if public health officials start recommending that the general population starts wearing masks, these shortages will get much worse.
The last thing that we would want is for individuals to buy masks, hoard masks, and really make it even more challenging for our healthcare workers who are going to be infected themselves and then infect other people as a result. There may come a time when widespread mask usage in the U.S. makes sense, but that time is not now, because that time also requires for our country to be at the point where we can begin to loosen restrictions on social distancing and when we have plenty of supply of masks and other equipment for healthcare workers. We are not there for either of these two milestones.
If you can sew, we need your time and talent to produce fabric face masks to protect Iowa's frontline workers.
But in the meantime, public officials and private citizens alike, from fashion designers to boat sailmakers, have been producing masks of all kinds to try and address this national shortage. Even without rock-solid evidence of their effectiveness, many argue a pandemic requires as many protections as possible.
So there are a lot of questions about what masks do you need in what situation and how much protection do they confer. The idea is that some barrier is better than nothing. Do you need evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's effective before people start wearing them? Or do we say that in this moment of time, it's prudent to do so? And I favor the idea that we should.
And just in the last 2 days, the CDC director, Robert Redfield, the U.S. Surgeon General, Jerome Adams, and Anthony Fauci all signaled a possible change in federal guidance about masks.
When we get in a situation
will we have enough masks? I believe there will be some very serious consideration about more broadening this recommendation.
We're making millions and millions of masks, but we want them to go to the hospitals.
President Trump has said mask manufacturers are working overtime, but so far he has not invoked his authority to order other companies to start making masks. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
As reports of coronavirus have spread across the U.S., so have incidents of anti-Asian violence. Amna Nawaz has more on that.
The coronavirus's origin in China has caused a backlash against Asian Americans in the first 2 months since the first positive diagnosis here. From schoolyards to trips to the grocery store, some Asian Americans have reported verbal and physical attacks, and the FBI has warned of a potential surge in hate crimes still to come. Beverly Leong told the NewsHour about her trip on the New York City subway.
He yelled at me on the train and said, "You people brought this virus here," before going to another part of the train car. And I found that really unsettling. My parents, me, my friends, we're all really on edge right now and kind of seeing how people react to us in public.
Stories like Beverly's led to the creation of Stop AAPI Hate, an online hate crime reporting tool that's registered more than 1,000 incidents in less than 2 weeks. Cynthia Choi is the co-executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action. She helped to launch the reporting website, and she joins me now. Cynthia, welcome to the NewsHour, and thanks for being here. What specifically are people telling you? You know, included in some of the reports on your site, people will talk about being spat upon, about having things thrown at them. I always like to mention when we talk about race in America, we have to remember Asian Americans are the most diverse racial group, right? So you're talking about dozens and dozens of different kinds of identities and ethnicities all under this one umbrella group. And one of the most fascinating things about your report I found was that 61% of all reports were from non-Chinese people. Did that surprise you?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, the target has been Chinese, and the assumption that those who are being victimized are of Chinese descent. But our report shows that it's affecting and impacting all Asian Americans. And for the simple fact that there might not be a recognition of the distinctions, but the fact that it's the Asian face, it's the perception that we're foreigners and that, again, we're all hosts of this infectious disease. And that's what's so troubling about it.
You know, Cynthia, I've talked to some leaders earlier in the month in the Chinese American community in San Francisco, and I remember them telling me that they didn't want to report any of these kinds of discriminatory or racist attacks because they didn't want to rock the boat. I wonder if you're worried that these numbers you're seeing right now are actually lower than what's really happening on the ground.
Absolutely. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's actually happening on a daily basis. And that we need to do better, I think, to reach those impacted populations, especially those that are less likely to report incidents to various agencies and are hesitant to report to law enforcement because of negative experiences or the feeling that nothing can be done about these incidents of hate.
Cynthia, I got to ask you about some of the rhetoric coming from the highest office in the land. President Trump himself has publicly referred to the virus, linking it to China, despite the fact that health experts here and across the world have said that that kind of rhetoric is dangerous. I want to play for you really quickly his remarks from a recent briefing. This was on March 26th.
I talk about the Chinese virus, and I mean it. That's where it came from. You know, if you look at Ebola, if you look at all Lyme, right, Lyme, Connecticut, you look at all these different horrible diseases, they seem to come with the name, with the location. And this was the Chinese virus. But I don't have to say it. If they feel so strongly about it, we'll see.
Cynthia, when you see the reports people are submitting to your online reporting tool, is there a way to link that kind of rhetoric to what people are experiencing?
Well, we think that insistence in the past of using or referencing the Chinese virus or other administration officials referring to it as the Wuhan virus certainly exacerbates the situation. And we know from our firsthand accounts on this tracker that we have individuals who are mimicking the president's words, parroting them, I should say, and that there are also individuals who reported their interactions of defending the president's words.
Cynthia, I should mention, just this afternoon, the former presidential candidate Andrew Yang published an op-ed talking about the fact that, despite the fact that 17% of America's doctors are of Asian descent or on the front lines of fighting this right now, people are scared and they need someone to blame. That fear is not going away anytime soon. We know the pandemic will be something we're dealing with for a while. I'm wondering if you're worried about the long-term effects of this, how you think this kind of fear and the blame that people feel they need to assign will play out over the months and the years ahead.
That's a really great question. One thing that I do want to point out is that throughout U.S. history, whenever there is a public health crisis or in wartime, different groups can be scapegoated and blamed. And certainly that's been the experience of Asian Americans, Muslims, African Americans, the Latinx community have also been subjected to that. And we do believe that long after we can resume normalcy and we beat this virus, we are very, very concerned in the Asian American community that this will have a lasting impact. We have yet to understand the full extent of what it will mean to come out on the other side. We don't think that the anti-Asian sentiment that we're seeing now is going to go away. And we're going to need to address that as a society.
We will indeed. That is Cynthia Choi, the Executive Director of Chinese for Affirmative Action, joining us tonight. Thank you.
We look now at a COVID-19 success story. Taiwan is just off the coast of mainland China. Millions travel between Taiwan and the Chinese mainland. Johns Hopkins University had predicted that Taiwan would have the second most COVID-19 cases in the world. But today, there are 80 countries and territories with more than Taiwan's 329 cases. Nick Schifrin follows a Taiwanese woman going home to figure out how they did it.
I'm currently at the Gatwick Airport in London.
When 28-year-old Anna Lee left her boyfriend to fly home to Taiwan last week, she took chances.
Why are you wearing a mask and gloves and goggles?
I'm trying to avoid any contact to air.
Lee didn't feel safe in Britain, where the airports are empty and the prime minister was criticized for a slow initial response.
If he is not even helping his own citizen, why would he help a foreigner like me? I thought, all right, I'll go back to Taiwan for now. Everyone's very careful.
So careful, Lee found fellow Taiwanese Jason Yang waiting for his flight to Taipei in a bodysuit bought off eBay.
I believe that in England, it's already lost control. And if I go back to Taiwan, I will be taken care of.
Taiwan is only 80 miles off the coast of mainland China. When Johns Hopkins modeled COVID-19, it predicted Taiwan would have the second highest number of cases. That prediction did not become reality. Taiwan has succeeded at containing COVID-19 starting at arrival.
We are getting off the plane.
Lee Skyped with us during her hour-long journey through the Taipei airport. The first step Taiwan took was identifying possible cases.
They gave me this form to fill out my temperature in the next 14 days.
Lee told authorities she'd had a cough in the last 2 weeks, so security escorted her to secondary screening. She had her temperature taken, like this woman, and she filled out forms consenting to new regulations and providing recent medical history.
My temperature lolly just took, and it was asking like what syndrome I had and if I went to doctor.
And she got a COVID-19 test at the airport. Taiwan uploads these results into its national healthcare database to create a kind of coronavirus database that everyone has to enroll in.
We have to register first online. They will send me a text message. I have to show them the text message or we can pass here.
That's where government tracking begins. After her bags are disinfected, her ride home is in a government-provided taxi by herself, The three-hour drive costs $80.
Now I cannot take any public transportation, so I had to use this contract taxi.
Lee headed home, knowing the government would stay in touch during a mandatory two-week quarantine.
Welcome to my humble house.
The government has also stayed in touch with Mickey Du, who arrived from Australia on March 22nd.
Well, the first day, they immediately phoned me that almost within an hour that I got home, okay? And there were actually several text messages. When I first arrived home, there were like three or four text messages. Welcome back to Taiwan. This is the CDC. We're just checking to see if you're okay.
Mickey's girlfriend recorded him in his apartment. Everyone who arrives in Taiwan today is tracked by cell phone to make sure they stay at home. Taiwan's Center for Disease Control tries to make 14-day quarantines easy.
She asked me whether or not I lived at this address. I said, yeah, sure, that is my address. And I said, when are you going to be here? She said, I'm going to be there in 5 minutes. I'm like, oh, okay. And no, they showed up in 4 minutes. They were like outside. Like, so she just gave me a packet of masks, and there were 14 masks in the packet exactly.
Taiwan was able to take all of these steps because it learned lessons the hard way.
The SARS outbreak is a wake-up call for Taiwan, and we learned a lot from the SARS outbreak.
Dr. Steve Guo is the former head of Taiwan's CDC and led the SARS task force in 2003 when the SARS epidemic made hundreds of Taiwanese sick and killed more than 70, the third highest tally in the world. The very next year, authorities prepared for the next crisis. That preparation allowed Taiwan's CDC to detect the COVID-19 threat before the Chinese government announced it.
We pick up the signal that there's some strange outbreak in the Wuhan areas at the end of the last years from a social media networks. We decided, and we did, send two medical doctors to Wuhan from Taiwan CDC to get a better understanding of what happened there, okay? And then 5 days later, on January 20th, the government decided immediately to set up and activate the central command centers.
That centralized command center launched border restrictions before almost anyone else, set local quarantine rules, and turned to technology. One phone app allows Taiwan residents to find stores with masks in stock. Another app provides information on all of those who are COVID-19 positive, where they've been, and their case histories. And the government made sure it had enough medical equipment.
After the SARS outbreak, actually, we have the law to require hospitals to have a stockpile for all medical supplies for 30 days for the hospitals.
Another reason Taiwan acted so early, they didn't trust either the Chinese government or the head of the World Health Organization, who in January praised China's response, says Bill Stanton, the former top U.S. diplomat in Taipei.
He was just defending the Chinese position and echoing what they had to say. And it made the Taiwanese even more suspicious to what the Chinese were doing for that reason. China doesn't allow Taiwan into the WHO. And that's really stupid because Taiwan is one of the main countries in the world that has expertise on international health issues.
For Anna Lee, that expertise translates into trust in her government.
I feel like even if there is something wrong with my body, I will be taken care of, which is quite promising. I'm quite happy with how government take it very seriously. That's why we keep the cases very low.
Which means for Anna Lee and many Taiwanese who are quarantined today, there's no place like home. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Today, Taiwan announced that it would donate 10 million masks to medical workers around the world, 2 million to the U.S. President Trump has been in the White House briefing room again this evening, along with other administration officials, for what has become a regular discussion of the COVID-19 response. And our Yamiche Alcindor joins us now with the latest. Yamiche, hello. We know so much of the focus today has been on those grim projections from the president, from the White House yesterday, about the number of deaths, the number of cases. What are you learning about how that is affecting the White House thinking overall?
White House continues to be the fact that more than 100,000 Americans could die from the coronavirus, even in the best case scenario. So President Trump today was talking about those numbers, and Vice President Pence made it very clear the White House was studying models. And on Friday, last Friday, they decided to finalize those numbers, present them to the president. On Saturday, when the president actually learned of these numbers, that's what the White House is saying, he was moved by this. And that's why he went from saying that the country could be possibly easing up guidelines by Easter Sunday to saying, no, we're going to have to keep these guidelines in place until April 30th. I want to put up this graph for people. This is a graph that the White House was using yesterday as they were describing it, and it's one that they've continued to go back to today. If you look at this dark hill, the dark blue hill, what you see is 1.5 to 2.2 million Americans could die if there was no intervention, if there was no social distancing. That's what the White House's worst case scenario is. Then if you look at the other hill, it's a smaller bump, it says that 100,000 to 240,000 Americans could die. Those are the numbers that we should be focused on today. That's the graph at the heart, at the heart of the White House's numbers. The president also made it clear that a lot of these deaths are going to be happening within the next month. And the important thing to note here is that the governor of New York, who is at this point the hardest hit state, he said that in his models, about 16,000 people will die in New York. That means 93,000 other people, he said, could be dying on other states and in other states. So what we see there is that this is obviously a big issue in New York, but he's saying that the deaths might be nationwide. So we should really be looking at this as we go forward.
So grim, so still so hard to comprehend those numbers. And so, Yamiche, you've been in the briefing. What more can you tell us about what the White House is saying today?
Well, Judy, it was a really different White House briefing than we've seen in the past. Today, the president began with talking about national security, and he said specifically that he wanted to talk about anti-drug operations, and he said that the Navy is going to be beefing up operations in the Pacific Sea, as well as in the Pacific Ocean, I should say, rather, and the Caribbean Sea, and they're going to be focusing on cartels, they say, that are trying to use the coronavirus outbreak to smuggle more drugs into America. Here's what the president said about that.
Well, for a long time, we've had a lot of drugs coming into our country, and it's not that it's increased. We've probably got it down a little bit, but it's still a tremendous number. Families are being ruined. Lives are being ruined. It's an incredible thing, especially as you're at this position. You would never believe it. I see things that nobody would believe. I see reports that nobody would believe. So I met with the group behind me, all of them, and we said, what do you think we can do? And they think they can interdict. They think that we can stop it before it gets to the shores.
So today, the president brought out national security officials. He brought out national security advisor. He brought out Attorney General William Barr. He brought out people like the Joint Chief of Staffs. These are people that we usually do not see at the coronavirus task force briefing. We usually see the top scientists talking. But he waited until the second half of the briefing to have the scientists speak. And he wanted to underscore that he thinks that this narcotics operations that he's having, that they are really the top priority, at least today, even though, of course, we're looking at those grim numbers when it comes to the coronavirus outbreak. So that's a really important point that President Trump was trying to make. Now, I should say that this comes with the context that there was a naval ship that was asking, a commander was asking that sailors be evacuated from that ship. It was docked in Guam. John Yang, of course, had that in the script and was talking about it at the beginning of this show. And what you see there is the president basically having this context, saying that there needs to be this anti-drug activity. The other thing I should note really quickly is that Adam Schiff, a prominent member of the House, says that after the coronavirus bill phase four is done, after more relief is given, he wants to see some sort of commission to really look at the White House's handling of the coronavirus outbreak. So we should be looking out for that as well.
For sure. Yamiche Alcindor monitoring it all at the White House. Thank you, Yamiche. And now a look at how the coronavirus pandemic has forced people in a way to change how they interact with each other and seek out new ways to connect and to celebrate. Lisa Desjardins has the story.
When Berkeley Souza turned 12 last month, a birthday party was out of the question. Her state, California, was under a shelter-in-place order.
She's a kid. She doesn't understand. There was a lot of, you know, I hate everything, and why did it have to be in March, and crying, and she was just really bumming. So we wanted to surprise her with something.
So instead of a party, her mom, Holly, organized a birthday parade. One car after another, filled with friends and family, drove by her Bakersfield home. One even had a special delivery for her, a cake.
Thank you, Chelsea.
Just to wake up and then come out front and see all the people come by was really cool, a really cool experience, and made me feel a lot better about my birthday.
Across the country, parades have also become tools for teachers trying to stay in touch with students while school is closed. They ride in a caravan and wave to families lining the streets. Families are finding new ways to connect with each other as well. Grandfather Dave Schneiders of Indianapolis visited his one-year-old grandson, David Drew, through a living room window. Nursing homes are off limits for most outsiders, so in Middletown, Ohio, Charlie Adams used a bucket truck to visit his 80-year-old mother on the third floor.
Make sure you wash your hands.
Yes. People are reinventing partying, too. DJ D-Nice has been spinning records live for people to dance at home. Just him, great music, and the occasional hat change. Sometimes 9 hours straight. One virtual party of his drew over 100,000 people watching, including celebrities.
Michelle Obama's in here. Oh my gosh, let's go. We are partying right now.
On a smaller scale, people are taking their talents to their front porches. Here's a recent classical violin performance for passersby in a Washington, D.C. neighborhood. In Saratoga Springs, Utah, Heather Downey taught a Zumba class for her neighbors from her backyard.
There's something about that endorphin rush that you get when you dance, and I think everybody can relate to that. Even if you feel like you can't dance, there's just something about moving that sends those happy endorphins out. And so it's been such a blessing to be able to move again.
When we'll all be able to move around freely again remains an open question. But for newly turned 12-year-old Berkeley Souza, she has already learned a powerful lesson.
Even though there's a lot of things going on right now in the world, you can still do something to make it better. Not everything can be negative about everything that's going on, and to just stay positive during this.
For the PBS NewsHour in Washington, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Stay safe. Have some fun. And we'll see you soon.